Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Gene Atkinson of the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, who assesses the conditions in Central America that led to the arrival of large numbers of immigrant children to the U.S. border and options for addressing the humanitarian crisis. Kenneth Margulies of the Worker Institute at Cornell University, who examines the recent Supreme Court ruling in the Harris versus Quinn case and the impact it could have on public employees and the nation's broader labor movement. And Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, who discusses growing concern about the U.S. military role in Iraq's current conflict with ISIS insurgents. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Nairobi neighborhood in Eastleigh, often called Little Mogadishu, has emerged as a center in Kenya for refugees fleeing conflicts in the Horn of Africa. The area is bustling with traders and nightlife, where many conversations are spoken in Somali and Arabic. In recent months, fear has gripped Eastleigh, reports the Christian Science Monitor, as the Kenyan government has targeted the neighborhood in response to the fall 2013 attack on the upscale Westgate Mall by Somali-based Al-Shabaab Islamic militants. Over a two-month period, Nairobi police have conducted multiple raids on Somali neighborhoods with indiscriminate arrests, beatings, and extortion. Somali nationals are now leaving Kenya in droves. The police crackdown has prompted a spike in terrorist attacks, including a May 16th car bombing in Eastleigh that killed 12 people. Meanwhile, the Kenyan government continues to deport hundreds of Somali refugees from Nairobi, flying hundreds of migrants back to Mogadishu in violation of international refugee law, banning the return of people to the place they fled. American citizens who deposit money in overseas tax havens like Switzerland face a tough new law, the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, or FACTA, that requires foreign banks to report offshore accounts to the U.S. Internal Revenue Service. The law, originally passed in 2010, went into effect on July 1st, targeting offshore accounts over $50,000. It is the latest attempt by the U.S. tax officials to pressure known tax havens to disclose all foreign accounts. The Obama administration has successfully prosecuted Swiss banks, including UBS and Credit Suisse, for tax evasion. In May, Credit Suisse was fined $2.6 billion for helping Americans avoid paying taxes to the U.S. government. As FACTA regulations were enforced, 77,000 banks in 80 countries, including popular tax havens in Switzerland and the Cayman Islands, have agreed to comply with the law. Now, foreign banks that are found to be out of compliance face a 30% withholding tax on payments originating from the United States. FACTA is projected to generate nearly $9 billion in U.S. tax revenue over the next decade. Progressive mayors are winning office in cities across the United States, building on insurgent labor community alliances that are fighting for fair wages and workers' rights with a focus on immigrants and minorities. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is the most high-profile of these newly elected progressive mayors, but he shares a common agenda with mayors in Pittsburgh, Minneapolis, and Seattle. Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto told the American Prospect magazine, "We all feel the realities of growing disparities. The population beneath the poverty line is increasing everywhere. A lot of us were underdogs, populists, and reformers, and the public was ready for us. 20 years ago, half of Americans' big cities were run by Republicans. Now, only San Diego remains in GOP hands as a new wave of immigrants and tech-savvy young professionals have taken up residence in urban areas. In addition, mid-sized cities like Pittsburgh have seen the emergence of powerful progressive service sector labor unions who represent the interests of the urban working poor." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
In recent weeks, the large number of unaccompanied children from Central America crossing the U.S.-Mexican border has captured headlines and prompted a renewed national debate on immigration reform. The surge also set off an ugly anti-immigration protest on July 1st that blocked three government buses transporting 140 immigrant children and their mothers to a border patrol station in Murrieta, California. A combination of extreme poverty, violence, and misinformation about U.S. immigration policy has encouraged an estimated 50,000 child immigrants from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala to make the dangerous journey to America's border over the last 9 months. In response to the influx, the Obama administration has requested $3.7 billion in emergency funds to pay for an increase in the number of immigration judges, border patrol agents, aerial surveillance, and new detention facilities. While many conservative legislators are calling for the immediate deportation of these children, the William Wilberforce Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, passed with bipartisan support in Congress and signed into law by President George W. Bush in 2008, requires that children entering the U.S. from nations other than Canada and Mexico without a guardian must appear before an immigration judge. The law also recommends that minor immigrants should have access to an attorney and an advocate, placed in the least restrictive setting that is in the best interest of the child, and be reunited with family members when possible. In recent days, White House officials have suggested that they may seek flexibility in enforcing the law's requirements. Your reporter spoke with Gene Atkinson, Executive Director of the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, or CLINIC. Here she examines the conditions in Central America that led to the arrival of large numbers of immigrant children and the options open to President Obama to use his executive power to address the current humanitarian crisis and advance a more just immigration policy.
I had the honor, I would say, of going to southern Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras in November to look at what is pushing these children to come to the United States in large numbers. And these are the countries that are sending most of the children, those three Central American countries predominantly. We met with children who had been picked up in Mexico on the journey and detained. We met with mothers and aunts and grandmothers waiting for the return of their children because, of course, we're talking about the children who've made it to the United States, to the border. Many of them don't make it that far, and they're picked up on the way and then returned back to their country of origin. There's clearly not one factor only that's pushing these youth to seek safety, but the overriding factor that we saw and heard about over and over again was the escalation in violence. It is at every level of society. I would say the escalation is due in part to a shift from localized gang activity to a more organized transnational crime. It's part of everyday life in these countries, and the children, unfortunately, are the direct target of the gangs. Added to that, I'd say there's an inability of some of these countries, these governments and the communities to protect the children. And we heard numerous people in different ways just call it a hopeless situation. People are leaving truly because they are afraid for themselves. Parents are letting children leave because they fear for their lives. During our trip, we had one woman say she would rather her daughter die trying to get to the U.S. than die on her doorstep. And those were what she saw as her two options.
Gene, there was a particularly ugly protest in California where protesters blocked some Homeland Security buses carrying immigrant children and their mothers. What would you say to these protesters who seem to be less looking for solutions to immigration problems than to cast blame and, in all frankness, exhibit a lot of hatred towards these immigrants?
You know, I think my first question would be, if this were your child, and I say this as a parent of three boys, so if your child's life depended upon getting your child out of a country, what would you do? And then turn that around. How do we treat these are children? They're human beings, but they're children, even the most vulnerable. How do we treat them? It is sad to see what's been happening because generally Californians are in favor of immigration and immigrant rights through, you know, polling at least, shown themselves to be in favor of immigration reform, for example. I would say we don't do well as a country. We have not done well as a country when we act out of fear. I think we need to find a way to receive the people who are coming here that's consistent with American values. At the same time, we take a comprehensive approach to resolving this situation.
Well, Gene, as you and many of our listeners are well aware, there is gridlock in Congress over efforts to pass legislation that would usher in a comprehensive immigration reform. And it doesn't look like anything's going to be moving soon in Congress. President Obama has recently said that he may use his executive powers to move the failed U.S. immigration system in a more just direction. What would that look like? What would you advise President Obama to use in terms of his executive orders to set things right, at least in a temporary way or in a, you know, in a way to patch some of the problems that are urgent?
If we're talking about kind of a solution to this current issue with the unaccompanied minors, which is very distinct from immigration reform overall, I think the approach is multifold. I think a comprehensive approach to this issue with the unaccompanied children has to address the root causes back in the home countries of these children. We really should be strengthening these children's ability to apply for U.S. protection in their home countries, as well as countries of transit. Because if you give that opportunity, then you can make it an orderly program. And this has a history. It's been done in Haiti. It's been done in Cuba, Iraq, former Soviet Union, Vietnam. So that is something that is very doable. I think we need appropriate care and legal protections for the children who arrive at our border that are consistent with our international obligations. That, of course, the administration can do, and the administration is already taking trips to the Central American countries to talk with leaders there on some of these other issues. We are not in favor of detaining these families, the mothers with the children who are coming, but if there is going to be detention, it should be the least restrictive form of detention possible. There are some alternative to detention programs, which are very successful, have high rates of people showing up for their immigration proceedings, so we would encourage the administration to expand those alternatives to detention for the family units. And then there needs to be assistance for the children when they're returned to their home countries. Finally, there has to be prosecution of the traffickers who are abusing these children. That's on the unaccompanied minor issue. As far as the president's executive authority to enact some immigration reform, there is a long history of presidents being able to do that. We currently have a program, which I'm sure many of the listeners have heard of, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, and that is for undocumented youth who are in the U.S. and have been here for many years now. There has been talk of expanding that program. So the president, using his discretion, could expand it perhaps to family of these children who already have this status. Perhaps it could be for those eligible for the Senate's version of comprehensive immigration reform. It could be for certain groups of workers who are working in the U.S. or perhaps mixed status families. So families, and there are many, many of these in the United States where some members of the family have legal status, often citizenship, and others are unauthorized. There could be humanitarian parole for these children coming in. There could be an end to programs that require the local police to engage in immigration enforcement, such as, again, people may have heard of something called secure communities. These programs take the police away from where they really need to be focusing their efforts. In addition, they damage relationships in the community, which is vital to protecting communities and preventing crime. So those are just a few of the considerations that I think the Obama administration will be looking at.
That was Jean Atkinson, Executive Director of the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, or CLINIC. Find more news and commentary on U.S. immigration issues by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Supreme Court's ruling in Harris v. Quinn, an important labor rights case on June 30th, was understandably overshadowed by the justices' controversial Hobby Lobby decision that allowed privately held for-profit companies the right to deny birth control coverage to their employees based on an employer's religious beliefs. In Harris v. Quinn, the court ruled that certain home health care workers are partial public employees because they are paid through Medicaid to provide care for their own family members. The conservative majority's decision means that workers who choose not to join a union do not have to pay union dues in an Illinois district where a majority of home care workers voted to be represented by the Service Employees International Union. That ruling was partially based on the free speech rights of those employees. The conservative court majority specifically said they were not overturning the precedent case in Abood v. Detroit Board of Education, which declared every employee represented by a union, even though not a union member, must pay union dues supporting the cost of the union's collective bargaining and contract administration activities. But Justice Samuel Alito, writing for the majority, called into question the Abood precedent, inviting a future challenge, signaling that conservative justices may be ready to overturn it which would spell disaster for the American labor movement. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Kenneth Margulies, a senior associate at the Worker Institute at Cornell University. Here he explains what the Harris versus Quinn ruling means and the impact it could have on public employees in the broader labor movement.
The Supreme Court ruled in this specific case of the home care workers involved that they did not have an obligation to pay that fee because it violated their free speech rights. And so, but it only applies to those particular employees because the court found that they were not full public employees, but rather partial public employees.
I guess from the point of view of some of these workers who are taking care of their own family members and who chose not to join the union, do you think that's a legitimate distinction from full public employees?
Well, it is a somewhat unusual work situation where somebody is being paid to care for their relative. And I think, you know, the basis for that is that either the family member wouldn't get any care because the caregiver would have to get another job, or the total income for the family would be so low that they'd hard to survive. I think that's why they decided this was a reasonable thing to do, plus being cared for by a family member is usually preferable to someone you don't know. But I think in terms of are they employees or not, I guess it's kind of non-traditional employment, and I think there's been a lot of activity lately of jobs that people didn't think of quite as full employees that they're now thinking of as employees, like, you know, nannies and home cleaners and things like that, who have generally been excluded from the labor laws. And so they're now saying, wait a minute, look at what we do. We do important work. If it didn't get done, somebody else would have to do it. We should be treated like any other worker.
Ken Margulies. So in that sense, it's an advance for workers. But in other ways, like this Supreme Court decision, we seem to be moving backwards. What do you think will be the impact of this decision?
Well, I think this decision is eroding some of the basic foundations of unionism in the United States. And people sometimes look at this issue, should you pay dues even, you know, you should pay a fee even if you don't want to be a member, maybe you disagree with the union. The main reason that happened was because in days when violence was often used or blacklisting and things like that was used, if the people weren't required by the contract to join, the employer would work on them individually to get them to quit. And that is a lot of it. I mean, it's also to support the work of the union, which is a lot of work, and so it should be supported by everyone who benefits from it. But I think there's been a steady stream of things that are eroding the power of unions, and I think this is going to contribute to it by you kind of whittling away at, well, who is an employee and who isn't. And there's no secret that Judge Alito, who wrote the opinion, is a very, very low opinion of organized labor and probably would have gone further if he could have gotten the votes.
It sounds like you see the decision as opening the door wider to anti-union moves. What do you think is a possible response from the union movement and supporters of unions?
You know, there's a number of things that unions know they need to do and that they've been doing the best to pursue them. And I think that there's no one thing. There's probably a legal strategy that I'm not that up on because I'm not a lawyer. But I think broader unions have to do everything they can to increase the loyalty of their members so that there are fewer and fewer people who choose not to join. And it's interesting because in right-to-work states, mostly in the South, there are many examples of where unions get, you know, 90% membership because they're forced to, and they have a lot of effort to talk to each person and make sure that they understand what the union's about and why they should be supported. In a situation where you get the money anyway, it allows unions to be a little more lax and not necessarily make the effort to talk to everybody and explain to them what the union is all about. So you have a number, you know, I have a kind of reservoir of people who are kind of anywhere from indifferent to the union to perhaps resentful that they have to pay.
That was Ken Margulies, a senior associate at the Worker Institute at Cornell University. For more analysis of the Supreme Court Harris versus Quinn ruling and its impact on the U.S. labor movement, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since June, fighters with the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, have captured dozens of cities and towns in northern and western Iraq, in addition to territory the group has seized inside Syria. The leader of the extremist Sunni group, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, has announced his intention to form a caliphate or Islamic State spanning both Iraq and Syria, and demanded that all Muslims pledge allegiance to him. Responding to the ongoing crisis in Iraq, the Pentagon announced on June 30th that President Obama had ordered hundreds of additional U.S. troops to Baghdad, along with helicopters and weaponized Predator drones. Administration officials say the second deployment since early June is being made to reinforce security at the U.S. Embassy and provide trainers and advisors to the Iraqi military. According to a report from Al Jazeera, this latest announcement brings to nearly 800 the number of combat-equipped American soldiers who have been sent to Iraq during the current crisis. Although President Obama has not yet launched U.S. airstrikes targeting ISIS forces inside Iraq, administration officials say they have not ruled them out. Meanwhile, Iraq has sought and received military support from U.S. adversaries Iran, Russia, and Syria to battle ISIS insurgents. The White House, joined by world leaders and critics inside Iraq, have called on Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to step down from his post to make way for a more inclusive government. But Maliki is determined to win a third term as head of state, as the Iraqi parliament charged with forming a new government has deadlocked and adjourned until August 12th. Your reporter spoke with Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, who discusses growing concern about the U.S. military role in Iraq's current conflict with ISIS insurgents.
I just believe that there is simply no military solution to the crisis in Iraq, nor is there a military solution to the Syria-Iraq war. We need political, diplomatic approaches. I mean, the crisis in Iraq is part of a larger regional conflict, fueled in part by longstanding sectarian divisions and regional powers willing to use the combatants to fight proxy wars. So what's needed? American diplomacy, not American bombs. President Obama has wobbled back and forth in many ways. I mean, part of the problem is I'd argue the president deserved credit for restraint from a further military involvement. Look, you know, considering the drumbeat for war inside the Beltway, not just from the neocons who are surging back, but also liberal hawks. But the drumbeat has become such that he's now, as you said, decided to send up to more than 300 special forces advisors to Iraq. And we know the history. You know, history has shown all too often advisors can become ground troops despite the best of intentions. And, you know, the last point is I'm confused on any given day. You may be too, Scott, but you're looking at a very complex situation in the region. And Iran, for example, a country this nation has waged all kinds of drumbeats of war against, is now our potential ally in fighting the Sunnis in Iraq. And there's a drumbeat to arm rebels in Syria when at the same time those very forces out of Syria are fighting on our side in Iraq. So it's very complicated. I think our media is not doing a great job in explaining much of this to us. But one thing at the core, it just is futile to throw the U.S. military at a problem that even the military agrees has no military solution.
Well, Katrina, the Constitution and the War Powers Act call for Congress to authorize U.S. involvement in hostilities abroad. And I'm wondering, as you look at the current situation, should President Obama seek authorization for the apparent new U.S. military intervention going on now in Iraq? It's what he almost ended up doing with his proposal to bomb Syria after the alleged use of chemical weapons there.
In being pushed last August to go to Congress, look what emerged. Instead of military strikes, we saw a program which has gotten too little attention, maybe rightly so because of the humanitarian crisis in Syria. But the dismantling and destruction of Syria's chemical weapons has been a major success, not only for U.S., Russian, Iran cooperation, but as a model for nuclear nonproliferation attempts. Of course, there is a need for congressional authorization for the use of military force in Iraq. You know, legal experts are clear that neither the 2001 authorization for the use of military force passed so quickly in the days after 9/11, nor the 2002 authorization for use of military force to authorize the Iraq war are sufficient legal authorizations for new military intervention. The president must seek authorization for Congress before using military force in Iraq.
As you alluded to earlier, Katrina, we have a very strange shifting set of alliances in the Middle East, with the United States supporting both sides in two conflicts. The U.S. supports rebels in Syria seeking to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, but also now is on the same side as Syria and U.S. longtime enemy Iran in opposing ISIS. At the same time, it's alleged that longtime U.S. ally Saudi Arabia has been a major supporter of ISIS rebels. Do you feel this is a window onto a confused and outdated U.S. policy? Or maybe, more hopefully, is it an opportunity to realign U.S. policy to better reflect the realities in a dramatically changed Middle East?
I think the latter. I think we seize this opportunity of these shifting alliances, first and foremost, to try and normalize relations with Iran. I think one of the great openings a year ago, maybe more now, but with the election of the new president, Rouhani, was an opening to end a futile conflict with Iran, to find a way to normalize its civilian nuclear program and to regain an engagement that is critical for the security not only of the United States but of the region. I think we have made a terrible mistake, despite the horrific humanitarian conditions in Syria, in arming rebels there. The region is already awash in weaponry. Have we learned nothing from arming the Mujahideen decades ago in Afghanistan? Those weapons might well, as we're seeing, turn against us. We have the opportunity to realign Saudi Arabia and Turkey's engagement with the region. So again, I think there is an entente between Iran and Saudi Arabia, both of which are terribly alarmed by ISIS's recent gains, and both of which could become Saudi Arabia in its own craven way, has been an ally of the United States, but I think Iran could now become engaged in strong ways. So I think there's a real opportunity here, but I think it has to be a kind of grand bargain where you bring together the countries of the region. And never forgetting the people, Scott. I mean, I spoke earlier of the success of dismantling chemical weapons in Syria. Again, an example of collaboration between Iran, Russia, the United States. But the humanitarian catastrophes in the region cannot be ignored, and more militarization of the crisis is going to lead to even more displaced people, more refugees. We should be doubling down on providing aid and fighting obstacles to getting aid to people in the region. That's what our mission should be, and that's where the United States becomes more aligned with the aspirations of the region, not simply fueling the weaponry of the region.
That was Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. For more perspectives on the current crisis in Iraq, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.